This episode is sponsored by Gusto, online payroll and benefits software built for small businesses. You're listening to Nakedly Examined Music, a podcast about songs and songwriters. My name is Mark Lintonmeyer. My guest for episode 251 is Alan Williams. He studied at Boston's New England Conservatory of Music and then released two albums with folk rock band Knots and Crosses in the early 90s. He put out his first solo album in 1994. You are right now hearing Neon Dreaming from that first album, Evidence, though this is a remix with a new lead vocal that he released in 2020. He then became a freelance music engineer and got his PhD in ethnomusicology. He now teaches at the University of Massachusetts Lowell. During his time there, he released three albums in the teens as Birdsong at Morning, and has subsequently released two more solo albums. We discuss Just Like Water from the latest of these, Floating on the Dreamline, and look back to The Great Escape by Birdsong at Morning from A Slight Departure, 2015, and the title track to Curve of the Earth by Knots and Crosses from 1993. For more information, go to alanwilliamsevidence.com. For more about this podcast, see nakedlyexaminedmusic.com, and you're going to want to subscribe directly to that feed if you are listening through the Partially Examined Life feed, or better yet, get your episodes ad-free along with my detailed episode notes if you support the show for even the smallest amount at patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic. So I will play a little of Neon Dreaming from Evidence, your first solo album, originally 1994, remixed, re-recorded partially for this Evidence Unearthed version 2020. We're going to get pretty quickly to the new things, but let's talk about, I know you were in Knots and Crosses, had some albums before that, but this was your first solo album. Anything about the journey? It seems like you've had a intermittent journey, but a lot of recent activity, like getting the final version of this album out, for instance.
Right, that's a good point. So the Knots and Crosses story is late 80s, early 90s. And then when that band folded, I figured now's the time to do my solo project that I've always dreamed of doing, and did it. But I had sung harmony a lot, some leads in Knots and Crosses, but mostly was a harmony singer. And one of the weird techniques was to blend with the lead singer was to round off all the consonants.
Okay.
So what I found was when I went to sing lead vocals, I was still kind of singing them like this. So the end result to me was fine. Like, yep, that's good. Feels good. But I don't think anybody else necessarily thought it was really working. And I know I went to South by Southwest thinking, I'm going to play this for people and get some feedback, and that'll give me some momentum. And instead, I played it, and someone said, well, the production sounds amazing, but I'm not really connecting with the singer at all. So I had 1,000 CDs pressed to go sell, and I have 995 of them still in my closet. I decided not to release it. So it was an entire album's worth of songs that, you know, the whole thing just felt like a terrible black mark. But at some point, I started doing some solo shows, and at that time, I'd been writing these sort of ballads. So I thought, I need some upbeat anythings. And I realized there were some songs from what initially was called Evidence that were upbeat. So I started performing them, and I realized, I think the songs are actually okay. What was my problem? And I went back and listened to it, and I realized, you know, it is the vocal. You just don't sound like you. I didn't feel like I was connecting to the song. I was probably way too self-conscious. So anyway, just before the pandemic, I transferred all the original tracks, turned out the band played well, it was well recorded, and I re-sang all the vocals. And since I was re-singing things, there are some changes to arrangements here and there, but it's mostly a recording from the mid-90s with vocals from the late aughts. And on something like Neon Dreaming, there's somewhat elaborately layered harmony vocal bits. I didn't feel like doing those. I'm too lazy. So those are me from the mid-90s with me from the late aughts singing leads. And
sure,
it's a weird thing to hear yourself be young again.
I've re-sung a couple things from the 90s myself that like, that was not the greatest attempt. All right. Well, so the shape of the career after that, that you did not persist in the solo career, that you jumped into this Birdsong at Morning. Well, that was not till, I see, it formed in 2006.
Yeah. A 10-year gap there. Part of that 10-year gap was I fell more into doing studio engineering production work. Mm-hmm. And parallel to that, I was invited to, at the last minute, with no preparation, teach one course at a university. And when I stepped into the classroom with no experience and no prep, I found that I really enjoyed it. By about the third weekend, I started to really think about taking academia maybe seriously as a career path, though I had no idea what that meant. So it took me a few years to realize that no one was going to hire me full time unless I had an advanced degree. And I thought, there's no way I could ever do that. I can't afford it. What are we talking about? I'm too old. And then somebody told me, if you choose a strange enough program at certain institutions, they need people to enroll. And if they're well-funded institutions, they can often waive your tuition. And because you do have teaching experience, they might pay you to help teach courses. So that's what happened. And I ended up eventually earning a doctorate in ethnomusicology at Brown University, which was like an hour's drive from where I lived. I was so sure that it wasn't going to work that I never moved to Providence. I just figured I'll just drive because I'm sure they're going to kick me out in a week or two. And I taught at UMass Lowell now for over 30 years. So Birdsong at Morning grew from picking up a guitar and trying to distract myself from, I couldn't finish my dissertation, so I would pick up the guitar and figure I was doing something productive, even though what I really should be doing is finishing the dissertation. Because I'm originally a keyboard player, playing standard guitar chords, just there's too much in my mind, too much I know about theory. I know what chords go to what chords and blah, 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 blah. And it feels like it just instantly kicks into formula. So for me, in the mid-aughts, I was doing altered tunings on guitar so that I didn't know what was going to happen under my fingers and new sounds, chords, transitions would emerge. And so the whole Birdsong at Morning thing became initially a much more quiet, acoustic-driven, exploring the new harmonic kind of languages from the altered tuning bits. But gradually, my rock history began to creep in. So the Birdsong at Morning catalog starts quiet and gets a little noisier from album to album to album.
All right. And then you become a solo artist again, getting into the pandemic. Is that coincidental or that?
Yeah, part of it was looking at resurrecting the Evidence album. That didn't feel like I should call that Birdsong at Morning, even though a lot of the same musicians have played on everything I've ever done, and they're on all those records. It still didn't feel like the same thing. So I'm going to put out a record under my name. Then during the pandemic, it was impossible to get together with musicians and do stuff. So the music I started to write and record, I was doing it on my own, doing the file sharing things that we all do. And I realized that the music had kind of taken a different turn. It's not totally disconnected from the later period of Birdsong at Morning, but it seems like something different. And I realized maybe this is just time to, I've put out one album under my name. Now let's just keep doing that as me.
So Floating on the Dreamline, the new one, is your third full album under your name.
Yeah.
Yeah. Say a little where you're at with this, and we're going to hear the first single from last year, Just Like Water, remixed for the actual album.
Floating on the Dreamline, new album. I think one of the things that happens for me as a songwriter is you start to create something and then you realize, okay, if I want to take this seriously, that's going to mean a big commitment of time, energy, money, and I'm getting old. Am I sure I really want to do this? So you write a batch of songs, maybe you finish an album and you're thinking, great, from now on, don't touch anything because you don't want to write a new song. You want to stop. And then what happens is some weird new song emerges. And the quandary is, okay, I could finish this and then I'll have a problem, or I can ignore it. And this album began that same idea. There was a little testing the keyboard piano part and plunked out a couple of chords and the little thing got in my head. And then it seemed like, well, maybe this is a little piece of piano music that I'll never need to play for anybody. But then other ideas start to creep in. So Floating on a Dreamline kind of was me at first avoiding making an album. And that's why there were singles like Just Like Water that came out far in advance of the album, because I was recording in little batches. And there's also the notion that I'm a child of the 70s, right? 60s, 70s, and albums are how I think. But that's not how most people now connect to music. So with notions of, okay, if you're thinking about streaming platforms, just think about a song or maybe a batch of songs, the so-called EP or whatever it may be. Maybe it's not an album. So, okay, I'll work on a few songs and we'll throw out a few songs at a time. But because I'm an album person, the songs started to feel like there was some reason to group them all together. And once I realized that, it became a matter of saying, okay, I think I've got a 4/5 of an album. What do I need to write to kind of fill it out in a way that makes sense? And Dreamline is a little bit stylistically all over the place. So there was some concern amongst the folks that I work with that maybe it was too all over the place and wouldn't speak to an audience. Because if you like the little fake bossa nova, you're going to really hate the prog song and these piano ballads are only going to work. And, you know, so, but then I thought back to the records that I really love, like the Beatles' White Album or Stevie Wonder's Songs in the Key of Life, or even, you know, Fleetwood Mac's Tusk, like big expansive records that go in all sorts of directions and they're all by the same artist. And I don't know. I think all of those went to number one and people bought them and enjoyed them and related to them. So maybe there could be something, maybe I need to see it as a positive that there's all sorts of genre play going on. So that's what Floating on the Dreamline kind of ended up being.
In these days, ever-failing plans, toss the coin, never ever lands. Holding on to ever-shifting sands that slide through my hands, just like water. Judgment days, confessions and alibis, fall from grace, broken and paralyzed. I hide my face from the mirror of your eye, reflecting the light, just like water. Leaving, I'll make my escape. Just like water. powerful force, just like water. I'm changing my course, just like water, seeking the source.
So I read on your website this is in an E minor tuning.
Yeah, so again, I'm playing around with guitar tunings. I remember reading an old interview with Andy Partridge, and he was just talking about why suddenly he was writing these acoustic folk songs. And he said, because I got a new guitar and I took it out in the garden and I just started to play. And when you get a new guitar, new ideas seem to emerge. So rather than buying new guitars, I try new tunings. And I think mentally, I just thought, well, what if you just change a couple of strings and you'd have an open E minor? I'll write some really dirgy ballads in E minor and then I'll move on. And instead, I did the tuning. I sat down, I was traveling in a van, I sat down at a picnic bench, and the first thing I played was the little opening riff to Just Like Water, which is a major tonality. And I started to think, well, okay, maybe this tuning can be kind of major-ish. And I found these sort of McCartney Blackbird kind of guitar voicings up and down the neck, and it was, oh, this is starting to feel like a song, but damn it, it's an E minor. So on the choruses, I like to show, but if I take my hand off the neck, boom, big E minor chord. That sort of musical juxtaposition made me think about a lyric thematic text, which then became about somebody going through transition, moving, contemplating, there's something changing, everything feels uncertain, everything feels ungrounded. And I think for many of us, at least for me, the moment of feeling ungrounded is really terrifying. And it's only after you've passed through the terror that you realize, well, this is opportunity. This is a new tuning. This could be all sorts of chords. I should take advantage of that. And that became the theme of the song.
Okay, so it's not just the acoustic that you're writing these Blackbird sort of riffs that are giving you the what sounds like a lead part that's under your verses, that's just you sliding on that. But are you then also tuning the electrics that way? So when the chorus comes in and you've got the big thing, are you still able to use the same voicings, or did you just go back to regular tuning?
I think there's a couple of electrics, and I think one is in the altered tuning to kind of beef up what I've got with the acoustics. And then, yeah, one or two are probably in standard tuning to give you a different option, the sort of rock power chord approach, which I kind of liked having the underpinning. And then the other little asterisk to my E minor-ness is actually the guitar part. I realized when I played it on an open E minor, it seemed just a little bland. So I voiced this other chord that gives me like an E minor six in it, and then I can open it up and make it an E minor. So it's got a weird little chord. So the electric guitars can hit the power chord. The acoustics can still kind of be in two places at once. Mm-hmm. Like somebody who can't make up their mind in a moment of transition.
So you're saying acoustics, right? I noticed, right, the first riff sounds very thick. And I was thinking, is this a 12 string? Well, it doesn't have those high chimey things. Are you just playing your acoustic twice, or is this just, you're engineering yourself, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Or is this just you adding a bunch of reverb or some other thickener to make that?
Well, there's all the thickeners, yes. But it starts with, I think Just Like Water, I think when I began to track it, it's because I knew I needed to go record some drums with my friend Ben Whitman in Toronto. So I needed to prep the three or four songs we were going to track, but Anyway, I used an acoustic guitar, but I didn't put a mic on it. I just ran the pickup into my board and said, yeah, this is just a demo. And because it sounded so thin to me and kind of bland, I decided, well, I'll do two takes of it and I'll hard pan them and they'll be stereo, but it's two different performances, that sort of 70s rock production technique. I like the sound of it. And it covers a little bit of, you know, momentary weaknesses in any given part. Like, there's two blood. Nobody will know. You kind of muff the one note. And the other thing about the process is because I record and engineer myself, what I tend to do is just play a take and roll back, play it again, and then maybe again, and then make a composite edit. So the quick down and dirty is just to say, well, take the first take, pan it left, take the second take, pan it right, move on. You got to move on. You got to be in Canada tomorrow. So then because I guess People have told me, no, I'm like a workaholic, but I think I have a really strong lazy streak. So often what starts out as demo, I'm going to definitely replace those parts. They end up in the final track. And I think that's what Just Like Water is.
Interesting choice of synth sounds in this, right? That it's as if you're trying to do horn string gestures, but you're using kind of 80s tones. Any thought of what, why?
Oh, yeah, I know why. One, again, I'm lazy. I was just testing this free little plastic keyboard that I got from school. Does it have any sounds I can use? But two, I think one of the musical inspirations for Just Like Water is an XTC song, to speaking of Andy Partridge, Love on a Farm Boy's Wages on Mummer. Mm-hmm. And in the middle of that, they're using probably, you know, state-of-the-art mid-80s Korg synths or something, right? But there's this beautiful layered monophonic set of lines that come in almost as if they were French horns. And so this is sort of my homage to the way they were using sneaking little tones in. I think it's a brilliant track, Love on a Farm Boy's Wages. And so it's cheap, cheesy. Back in the Birdsong days, and even I think my prior solo album, I wrote string arrangements and hired little mini orchestras, and we created big bombastic string sounds. And Just Like Water, the chorus would sure love to have a string orchestra on it to mock the lyric. In these days of ever failing budgets, I just thought, yeah, why spend those kinds of thousands of dollars when you've got a cheesy little plastic keyboard that will give you that same chord right now? And then you can kind of embrace the cheesiness of it, as you say, why are these mid-80s synth sounds showing up in your track? And so partly it's the laziness, partly it's my cheapness, partly it's also that the sounds reminded me of the song that kind of was in the initial writing stage, a reference point in the first place. So it feels a little full circle to me.
Let me just insert the transition between the second verse and then the first chorus.
Reflecting the light, just like water.
So right before the drums and everything comes in, where you get this transition with the synth, you sort of open it up a little bit. And were you actually changing sounds, or were you just playing higher?
Well, there's a string synth sound, sort of like a mock Krumar from the like Pink Floyd Wish You Were Here day, say. Just before that moment are the more monophonic lines that I was referencing before. Yep. And one of the techniques that I remember reading some interview with Brian Eno saying, a lot of times when he was laying down synth pads, rather than play a chord all at once, he would break it down into individual moving lines as if it were a violin player and a viola player and a cellist all playing separately, even though if you notated it, it would be the same. But there's something about the way one monophonic phrase as a melody locks into the next one. And so the chord stacks that you're hearing are individual layered little lines.
Let's stop for some sponsor talk. I again want to tell you about Gusto. I'm guessing a lot of you have a side hustle of some sort, like a podcast, a band. And at some point you want to pay other people to help you with this. So bam, you've got a small business, and even just getting one other person involved, the law is there looming over you with all its requirements. Well, Gusto is online payroll and benefit software built for small businesses. It's all-in-one, remote-friendly, and incredibly easy to use, so you can pay, hire, onboard, and support your team from anywhere, in accordance with the Byzantine requirements of the law. So when new employees start at the company that is my day job, they will get their W-4s, their I-9s, their onboarding docs, all automated, sent to them. It really makes it easy to add somebody new to the team. And Gusto is there, sending out these documents, storing these documents, making sure these documents are updated according to the law. If you've got direct deposit, if you've got health benefits, Gusto keeps track of the requirements for all these things and offers different plans for different types of businesses, so you're not paying for more than you're actually using. In fact, they even have it if you are not hiring somebody else, Gusto Solo. So wherever you're at, I recommend you just take a look at Gusto. And the way it's structured is you log into Gusto, all of the features are there for you to look at, for you to set up things, and they don't charge you a penny until you actually run your first payroll. It's quick and simple to switch to Gusto, transferring your existing data to get up and running fast. In addition to all these automated things, you get direct access to certified HR experts to help you support you through any tough HR situation. So people, And with your plan, you're going to get unlimited payroll runs for one monthly price with no hidden fees and no surprises. Try Gusto today at gusto.com/NEM and get 3 months free when you run your first payroll. That's 3 months of free payroll at gusto.com/NEM. One more time, gusto.com/NEM. Thematically, the introduction of this dark place out of this blackbird like thing. I mean, yeah. This really, the chorus, I don't know if it's full on prog. I'm sort of imposing some of what the Great Escape that we're going to talk about next. You almost sound like Asia to me, like that you have the John Wetton voice a little bit. And so I'm getting something from the sort of neo prog. I mean, maybe it's just, yeah, it's people that were fans of 70s prog that are doing things now that have big flourishes. But yes, I mean, what is this song, if you want to characterize? I don't want to ruin anything, but what is this even about in terms of, we're in this sort of, whether it's socially dystopian or personally dystopian, ever-failing plans, shifting sands, but now I'm going to do this. The chorus is not even the same both times. So it's escaping the first time, and then the second one, dreaming. So we're just, you know, reflecting the overall Pink Floyd-y, sloshy dreaming tone of this.
Okay, yeah, all of that. Everything you said is right, although I was never a giant Asia fan. I think if I'm going to lean neo-prog, I'll lean the 80s Crimson rather than... But I do love John Wetton's voice, and his singing on Red is just, you know, yeah, that's... That's like the stuff to me. So that's a compliment. If you're hearing any there, I'll take it. Thematically, it is an individual's transition, but also happening in a moment in time when the world around this person is also seeming to be untethered, unmoored in these days. Maybe that's my days, maybe that's everybody's days, et cetera. Again, it's sort of like if you get into the sort of Zen yogic mentality, then, and the song ends up talking about breath, like breathing, it's a powerful force, just like water. It's like, okay, in all of the chaos, if you just come back to center, you're there. You were always there. It's the lesson Dorothy learned in The Wizard of Oz. You were there all along. You were right there. You had us with you, blah, 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 blah. Okay. I tend to write a lot of layers of meaning for myself personally. So the lyric was written in the late fall of a couple of years ago, right around the time my hometown in North Carolina had been devastated by Hurricane Helene. So floods, flood waters were a destructive force. You know, we think often of water as something that purifies, water that blesses, water that cleanses, but it is also something that can destroy. So I was well aware of that writing the track. Lowell, Massachusetts, where I live and teach, is an industrial town built on a river. We harness the river for power, et cetera, and we reference the river in everything that we do. And the last little part was the building I teach in was going to get renamed in honor of a former chancellor who had been very friendly, very supportive of me. And I was asked to perform at the renaming ceremony. And I said, oh, well, if I'm going to do, yeah, let me bring something new. I don't want to do an old song. So I committed to play something new. And Just Like Water was the 90% done song. I thought, well, that'll work. And it'll kind of be about the river and kind of be about changing. We're changing the building, but it's not really. It's the same building, but a new name, blah, 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 blah. Thematically, it's going to work. But I could not figure out how to finish the damn song. So I was rewriting the lyric right up until the sound check. So if you were on the stage, you would see like six pieces of paper with big, bold words like, I think this is what I'm going to sing, but I've never sung the song start to finish. I'm about to play in front of 1,000 people. So that was a little unnerving. And the water theme was just ever present between the North Carolina situation, the Lowell situation, the unfinished song situation that, you know, part of me was like, well, maybe I'll just go up there and I will extemporaneously come up with a brand new song. I don't have that kind of talent, but so I just sort of scrapped down there. But interestingly, like even playing it brand new, nobody had ever heard it before, a number of people came up to me and said, wow, I love that you go to minor on the chorus. It's so different and unexpected. And I realized that, okay, so what's in my mind, the little music tools that inform thinking, you know, of course, they're completely audible. Everyone that's hearing it is hearing the thing. I may be constructing it as saying, okay, it's going to move from major to minor. That's going to mean something. Well, even if you construct it, when somebody hears it, hopefully all that construction is apprehended and people say, yeah, it caught me by surprise and I heard the words differently, or I heard a darkness in the words that I hadn't heard before. And then because the chorus resolves to a major, it feels like, okay, so you can be caught up in the rapids and then it comes to a calming, flatter, less churned up place, and it's peaceful and calm again. So I think the song kind of has cycles. You know, you could almost do that song on a loop. It's really just those two sections beating up against each other and eventually deciding, okay, we breathe in, we breathe out, and here we are now.
So I'm curious, as which was the part that was written in 5 minutes before the performance? Was it the white-winged bird, the leaving the earth? That seems like the... To me, a less zen, a little, you tell
probably.
Me.
Probably. No. I think that middle verse is the one that got changed around so many times. Mm-hmm. At some point in my writing, I did witness a big white bird getting caught in a wind thing and really just sort of surfing, gliding. So it's not like, can I resort to my gospel music cliche tropes that I'm aware of and just fill in a line here? There is reason for it to be there.
Okay.
But the risk with any songwriter is if you're going to use a phrase that's been used by everybody else, even if you have a legitimate reason to use it, it's going to be somewhat suspect, I think, for listeners. I know I've heard other people's songs and I thought, come on, you didn't really need to use the age old blah, 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 blah. So no apologies, but I take your point.
Well, there's more we could say about this, but we spent nearly a half hour. So let's get on to the second one, The Great Escape, the opening track from A Bird Song at Morning's A Slight Departure, 2015. Yeah, say a little about this before we hear this.
Yeah, so that track was an altered tuning that I had discovered in Hawaii, which was like a more commonly voiced drop C kind of thing. And if you hear a lot of Hawaiian music, it's often using this tuning. And I was trying to think, how can I use the tuning but not sound remotely Hawaiian? So there's a capo, and then I really did a little alteration, so it's no longer the Hawaiian tuning. Kind of almost some version of an open D minor thing, but way up the neck. Then what I think you might identify as kind of prog-ish in it is all the changing meters. Mm-hmm. And the changing meters are interesting in that I'm strumming the guitar and my strum never stops. It allows you to just play the same eighth note strum up and down, but you can play in seven, you can play in four, you can play in six, you can alter all this stuff, but the hand never does any changing at all. And the tuning that I use, even the left hand is barely, it's doing one little voicing. The open strings on the top ring throughout the whole song. So in a weird way, it's almost like a drone, a rhythm thing and a drone that's constant. And the rest of the band are making all the changes.
All right, let's hear it.
For the break of day. So grab your coat and leave the rest behind. Grab your coat and we'll be on our way. Have mercy, all you watchers in the night. Have mercy, look the other way. Shadows in the dark, over the wall we make our great escape. More to say. the future rushing by. Hear the sound and let the music play.
All right, it's a really interesting verse structure here. I've actually got a song like this that I was just working on that where it is stretched out because each line is a couplet, and then you've got an instrumental answering it, and then the other. So you got four of these together, and that's really, I think, one verse, but it sort of has the, is that the way you think of it, or you think of it as four verses? Something.
No. I think of it as one. So the entire song has three verses.
Okay.
Two up front, and then there's one in the middle.
Okay. So two. So at least two.
Yeah.
But each of those two has these. You know, we've got our presentation, and in this, the first one, you're significantly upping the energy level in the arrangement. That we're going to start with this talking while whispering thing, and that's going to do another little studio jump. And then when you do that the second time, when the instrumental comes in, you got your strings, I think, the first time there. So yeah, talk about the layering of all that stuff.
To counter the fact that my guitar part is doing the same thing from start to finish, I was trying to figure out, okay, so how do you build some dynamic in it? And that can be in the arrangement. So even if, as you've written the song in sections, okay, that's the verse, and then I know I'm going to go to six for the chorus, and the vocal's going to go a little higher, so that'll be more impactful. I'll make sure that that's big. But then you've got, as you say, these sort of, they're sort of sitting there for all those verses, not doing a whole lot. It's kind of the same. So the lyric tells a fairly linear story. And I just thought, okay, so we can make a visual narrative almost out of it. And each scene needs to introduce a character, introduce a slightly different setting, maybe the lights are coming on. Maybe there's just ways that I can think visually that I can then make a musical thing that says, I mean, the person is whispering into the ear, wake up, my love, it's time, this time is here. So that's somebody whispering, like they've come into the room. Now it's time to go. It's time to leave. Yeah, I just think there was a sense that I knew I needed to get big for the chorus because that's where the melody went, but that I could up the dramatic stakes as the couple makes their way out of wherever they are and climbs over a wall to escape and gets in their car. And then they're off and it's the great escape. Then it has to come back for the next verse. So you bring the dynamic level a little bit back, but now you're in the car. So in the middle verse, there's these sort of chunking electric guitars, chunk, 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 almost as if like they're riding on a really beat up road and you're getting the highway under the tires. And there's a little bit of the rethink. Wait a minute, we're on our way, but is this really the right thing to do? So it's the narrator kind of second guessing this whole big escape. And the sound of the future rushing by is the sound of the highway, the tires. Another big chorus. And then you get the guitar solo. And I write a lot of string arrangements. And one of the benefits of writing string arrangements is if I do them at the very end, the last thing that gets added into the recording, then if there's a guitar solo or some vocal flourish or something, you can then write a string arrangement that makes everything that happens in a solo seem predetermined. Like, wow, I can't believe how that line just fits with the strings. Well, it's because the strings are written in response to the guitar, sometimes in a way that you could set up the guitar. It might be, wow, three of those lines are just brilliant, but one of them's kind of not quite doing much. I'm not really sure what to do, but the strings can create the interest around that moment. To some degree, that's happening in The Great Escape, but that's a trick I learned way back when I had earlier recordings. I think they even maybe records I was producing for other people. And I just thought a string arrangement will help frame what's about to happen and make it make sense in a way that if we don't have the strings, it's going to feel a little unfocused.
Okay. So you're playing all those lead guitars, the solo here.
No, I'm terrible at guitar. I'm a rhythmic guitar strummer. The guitar on most of the Birdsong records, and on my Evidence Unearthed solo record, is Thomas Giuliano, who was a long-term friend. He was in a parallel band with Greg Porter. Greg Porter is the bass player that I knew in high school. We went to Boston to school together. We've played together forever, amen. And he played with Knots and Crosses and then was in a band called Talking to Animals with Thomas. So Thomas and Greg and I have been in each other's orbits for decades. And I think Thomas plays in a way that's just very fluid and kind of uniquely him. He doesn't do a lot of flashy stuff, but he plays lines that I find that I love, but I would have never, ever thought of. So that's who you'll be hearing when you're hearing the track. That's who's playing the solo.
Okay. Yes. I was noticing even on the new record that a lot of times the guitar solos were melodic and conservative, like you were saying. And so I thought maybe that was you doing it. But then you've got, for instance, Feel No Pain with Chris Gardino, who does a completely like, no, this is a specialist. This is a...
And he's a former student. On the new album, most of the people that are taking solos and featured vocals are former students. So it's like the benefit of being a teacher and watching these folks come through the building. You're like, ooh, there's a shredder guy. Okay. What I loved about what he played on Feel No Pain is that I asked him, I want you to play as many notes as you can play. And I know you can play a lot of notes, but if there's any way to kind of make it make some musical sense. And he listened to it and he said, oh yeah, I get this. It's sort of like Opeth. Yeah, I get it. All right.
Okay. Well, I'm sure you're a huge Opeth fan.
Well, I actually am.
Okay.
I wouldn't say huge, but I'm a fan. So he understood that I was asking for, and he sent me this solo. I think I asked for one little change, but I know the change I asked for was, you're totally referencing the melody all the time. Can you break away a little bit more? But oh man, this is great. The lead track on the album, Somewhere There's a Train, that's another former student, Matt Swanton, who's a blues guy. I just sort of felt like I worked with so many people that I kind of know what they do. And when you're writing a song, you're like, this is going to be a bluesy thing. Who will I get to come play it? It's not really Thomas Giuliano's thing, definitely not Chris Gardino's thing, but you know, Matt Swanton could really play this. And then you reach out, and almost always when I've reached out to folks and brought them in, they deliver even more than I expected. And I like that. Not that I'm some world famous rock star, but it's just another place where they can show up and maybe find an expanded audience that way. It's a little bit of a service. Like, can a teacher give a little homage to their former students and help get their careers moving as well, kind of a thing. And if I'm brutally honest, It works both ways. Can I ride the coattails of my far more successful students, right?
Well, looking back to Birdsong at Morning, can you say something about that as a band that you were saying that you've got some, even from Knots and Crosses, some members carrying forward, but this was definitely your thing. Did it start as a solo, you know, this is going to be my second solo album, but then a matter of what kind of image, what, like, was this band playing live? If so, was there some substitute for the strings, since the strings are pretty important?
All by accident is the Birdsong in Morning formed when a bunch of old people, me and a bunch of old people, realized we had stopped making music. And so we started inviting people to come, just let's sit around the circle and play some Beatles songs or anything to put instruments in our hands. And we did that off and on for a few months, and the number of people gradually dwindled down to just me, Greg Porter, and Darlene Wilson. And even then, we were still not doing original songs, but I had written a song, and I said, hey, you guys, I don't know, I have a song out of nowhere. I haven't written a song in a dozen years, but what do you think of this? And we were playing it, and I got to the chorus, and they just spontaneously hit a harmony. And we finished the run-through and sort of looked at each other like, whoa, that was good. Maybe there's something here. And so with great reluctance, at every step of the way, Birdsong at Morning became a band of those three people, supplemented by other musicians. Then I wrote a bunch of weird ballads and said, I don't know, I keep hearing strings on this stuff. Do you guys mind if I write some string arrangements? And at first it was for quartets. That's all I could imagine writing for. And then as the Birdsong stuff continued, the orchestras got larger. We did play a series of shows with a string quartet. And then I did a couple of shows at the university where we have a big enough stage where I could have a full band plus an orchestra and a chorus. And we did a couple of big blowout concerts with the full-on Birdsong sound. But it began very small, very intimate, and then grew. So by the time we get to something like The Great Escape, we're in the larger version of Birdsong at Morning. Yeah.
So was that, I saw Astronomy was your first single, at least that's on the streaming services. Was that that first original, or was that something else?
It's from the first batch of, we put out four quick EPs and then grouped them together in a box, but they're kind of all the same thinking. And so Astronomy is from that earlier set. You're just coming upon the new remix that came out.
Well, both of them are up. Maybe the old one is actually the remix too, but it's listed as 2011 on Spotify. Yeah, so by this point, you've got your big layers. One of the core three people is doing, I've lost track now, is doing the solo in here, or is that yet?
Nah,
one so, of the, okay, so you have your three, and then it extends to the whole rhythm section.
Right, and it's Thomas Giuliano, who we're speaking about, plays the solo on what we were talking about. Yeah, and he's sort of Birdsong adjacent. He played on a lot of Birdsong stuff, but he refused to be in any videos. So there was another former student that I would bring in to substitute for Thomas in all of the Birdsong videos. If you see anybody playing electric guitar, that's not the guy that you're hearing. On the other hand, he's a really good guitar player, so we would play lots of live shows with him. So it's the family expands.
All right. Maybe the reason that I thought this chorus sounded like Asia was the, so was that, again, is this you layering? Is this your core?
Yeah, that's Greg and Darlene. That's part of what Birdsong was, is if they're singing, then it's Birdsong. If we don't have their voices singing, I don't think it is Birdsong. But you're also right. One quick thing you mentioned, is it my project? I think I'd been in so many bands where I want to do my thing became such a problem that when we first started to say, are we going to do something? I said, okay, yeah, here's what I propose. Let's make it about my music. In exchange for that, I cover all the expenses. So you don't have to sacrifice anything other than your time, and I'll bear the burden of everything else in exchange for having you all perform the music. And in a weird way, it was great to just have that clear. It's not that Greg and Darlene don't have creative ideas. They can go do their own bits wherever they want to do them. But this is going to be my thing, and we don't have to argue about it. And that,
sure,
that's kind of interesting. Greg and I, as I say, have known each other since we were teenagers. On the brand new record, the last track is the first time he and I ever wrote a song together.
Huh.
Yeah. And he would argue we didn't really write a song together, but he played a little bass line in the middle. And I said, ooh, that's kind of cool. I'm going to sing that. And I thought, well, I think that's a co-write. So
okay. All right.
This podcast is sponsored by IQBar. I've got good news and bad news. Here's the bad news. Most protein bars are packed with sugar and unpronounceable ingredients. The good news? There's a better option. I'm Will, and I created IQ Bar Plant Protein Bars to empower doers like you with clean, delicious, low-sugar brain and body fuel. IQ Bars are packed with 12 grams of protein, brain nutrients like magnesium and lion's mane, and zero weird stuff. And right now, you can get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Try our delicious IQ Bar sampler pack with 7 plant protein bars, 4 hydration mixes, and 4 enhanced coffee sticks. Clean ingredients, amazing taste, and you'll love how you feel. Refuel smarter, hydrate harder, caffeinate larger with IQ Bar.
Go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Again, go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20.
We can't put this song away, The Great Escape, before talking about the time signatures. So just the fact that, I don't know if Asia would have played a 3-4 chorus. So maybe this is not Asia, but the fact that that's your 3-4 parts, right? And you've got some driving 4-4, and then it's in 7 is the riff that...
The verses are basically in 7.
Okay, right.
Or no, the verses are in 4.
Right.
The little interlude between verse lines is in 7, and then the choruses are in 6 or 3, if you want to think of it. Yeah, Crimson might have done that, but I don't think Asia would have done that. That's one of the things Asia would have said. Okay, in order to make money, let's drop all the crazy mixed meters.
Did that all flow naturally? I guess that's a good way to think about, you know, when you're using an odd time, is it because... you're trying to deliver something particularly jarring and jittery, or is it just, this is just the way it's flowing?
For me, it's the latter. It's just how it flows. A lot of times I'll get musical ideas while walking, and I must have some sort of lopsided gait because I tend to walk in 7 or 5. Like, just the little things that come to mind while I'm moving are often always odd meters. So for me, it's the sort of natural extension. And sometimes I have to go back and go, oh, wait a minute, as I just did, like, oh, wait a minute. No, the verses are actually in 4. It's only the interludes that are in 7. I don't really know. I'm just feeling it. The thing that maybe, I hope, lets me get away with it is the drummer. Ben Whitman is somebody that Greg and I met in college. We were roommates, and he's played drums on nearly everything I've recorded as well. He's one of those kinds of drummers that can make something really complicated seem just that it organically flows. And that's given me license to say, I'm not going to have to explain this to Ben. I'm not going to have to coach somebody through the weirdnesses of it. He'll understand how it ties together, and he'll play it in a way that flows. And so I kind of feel like I have a lot of weirdly metered stuff that comes up, but if you're not really paying attention, it shouldn't catch you off guard. I recognize there's a school of thought that says, let's do really complex meters because when you hear it, it'll turn your brain inside out. And there, I've loved music that does that too. But my approach is just, I happen to accidentally drop beats. I'm more like a John Lennon mixed meter guy than I am. Because if you know the Lennon stuff in the later Beatles period, it's metrically all over the place. And I think internally the band's like, yeah, John just forgets what he's playing half the time. But it creates really, like, All You Need Is Love is a weirdly mixed metered song. The song on the White Album, Happiness Is a Warm Gun, lots of mixed metery things in there. Oh, Good Morning on Sgt. Pepper. It's crazy. If you notate what he's doing, it's really weird. But it doesn't, I think, strike listeners that it is weird. It just flows.
Yes, if you use the 5 or the 7 or whatever as a jab, so we're walking along and boom, boom, jab, you know, or, you know, that you can move right to the next verse because the jab has
done the punctuation for you, yeah.
I mean, even Take 5, do, 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 bam, bam, do, 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 bam, bam, you know.
Right, right. And it's when they get to the B section of Take 5 that you start going, wait a minute, now it's not doing what I want. Now it's da da ba da ya ba da ba da ba da. Then it sort of swings for the first time. We always think of Take 5 when we think of the opening A section. It's the B section that interests me more.
While we're sort of on the academic run, are you teaching the full range of music theory, music history, musicology, composition, music business? What exactly are you teaching?
I'm kind of the pinch hitter. I kind of cover a lot of different mm-hmm. things. I run the music business program, but at this point, I don't really teach any of those classes. Mm-hmm. We have people with more current biz experience going on. I do teach some music history. I teach like a history of rock course, some music theory related stuff. I teach a kind of an intro to world music course, and I oversee a Cambodian music ensemble. I'm not the master teacher. We have somebody who really knows the music, but I've been doing it for so long that he and I do kind of co-teach it. So I can play a handful of instruments and walk students through what they're learning. And I've been given a great deal of latitude, either because I've elbowed my way into it or just because sometimes there are holes that need to be filled and I'm happy to jump in and say, oh, I could do that. For example, we have a whole recording, sound recording major, but I don't really teach in that, even though I do a lot of sound recording engineering work. But I'm one of the people that's never been trained and I don't really know what I'm doing. And our students are supposed to know what they're doing. So you don't want me teaching them. We'll talk about mixes in the hallway, but I'm not going to be the instructor of record for any of that kind of thing.
So I was a music minor, but of course was, you know, writing rock and roll, but I felt like if I was really going to, you know, be a real composition major, I had to immerse myself in this 20th century classical post 12 tone, just, you know, what all the, are the pressures completely different now in probably, I mean, this was like the early 90s that I was looking at that, and you didn't get into your academic career until a decade later, right? You were saying?
I started teaching mid-90s. So.
Okay. So, all right. So not that far off. Have you had to connect to that whole alternate world or did they actually let you like, oh no, rock is respectable. You get to teach a history of rock course, etc.
Yeah. No, I had to fight for the history of rock course, but what we've done where I teach at UMass Lowell, we did reinvent our core theory stuff for all music majors about a dozen years ago. And it was based on my experience as an undergrad at New England Conservatory. I was doing what they called at the time third stream studies. Now they call it contemporary improvisation. And what it really is a kind of non-genre way of thinking about everything. We were not allowed to use written notation at all. You had to use your ears for everything. And that meant maybe you're hearing some really strange George Crumb string piece. Okay, what is that? How is that functioning? But for me, what was interesting was to go, okay, so learn a Bach two-part invention by ear, not by eye. Once I did that, I was like, oh, you know, there's really no difference between what Bach's doing here and what Rick Wakeman was doing on this other thing. And it's not really all that different than what I hear in this Irish fiddler. And it's not really, you start to hear the connections that music has rather than the separations. So we've reconfigured our whole course. All of our music majors now are going to be subjected to, yeah, we'll listen to Fela Kuti. We'll listen to James Brown. We'll listen to Mozart. We listen to Stravinsky. We listen to Miles Davis Footprints, the Wayne Shorter tune, all the stuff early on. They're trying to make sense of all of it. And at the same time, we try to use that to scaffold how we do teach the more traditional ways of talking and writing and seeing what music looks like. So I'm part of a revolution in a weird way because some of our stuff is now being done in lots of other schools. I think if you were coming into most any music program at this point, it would not be nearly as strictly divided as you were subjected to. What's really funny is now that we're more than a quarter of the way into the 21st century, when we talk about things like 20th century music, well, that's old fashioned now. Like all the stuff that you were going, I have to grapple with it. Now it's just sort of, eh. And then there was that, but we don't have to really go deep into it.
Well, yeah. So it was kind of the same time in college that I was getting into prog rock, but also getting introduced to this contemporary classical scene. And it really gives you a different attitude on the prog rock, which seems like, oh, it's so cutting edge. You know, it's, you follow this through the Beatles experimenting through the 60s and then 72 or so is sort of the height of this. Let's write 20 minute songs, but they're using classical tricks from
19th century.
You know, yeah, yeah, exactly. So yeah, that's, you know, that if you want to actually push it, then it becomes, you know, the prog rock bands that did not become poppy in the late 70s, like Henry Cow / Art Bears, like those that they actually, you know, knew their. So it's much harder to listen to and never got popular. And most people probably don't know what I'm talking about because like if you actually continue to get progressive, then it gets unlistenable.
It's an interesting thing, the Henry Cow thing, or even like Can and that sort of thing, where I think I have students now that are coming into it going, oh, I really like Can. I'm like, oh, that's unexpected, but okay. But to give McCartney a little credit, he's listening to Stockhausen. He's going to, I think he went, there's a photo of him at a Luciano Berio electronic music like there's like 20 people in the room and McCartney's one of them. I think he was not thinking need to rip off Mozart and Brahms. I need to, what's happening right now was what was interesting to him. I think the Prague people though, I think the critique of Prague is that it distrusts the value of basic rock and roll. And I think those people apologized for liking rock, and the way they could justify liking rock was to say, but I also know everything there is to know about Brahms. I kind of feel like that's a little reactionary. And the more progressive people were the folks looking beyond the concert hall for inspiration and ideas. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think the 80s King Crimson is much more interesting to me because that's Fripp saying, you know, Balinese Gamelan is blowing my mind, and I really want to rethink how we're doing things based on that as a template. That's not trying to do big, sweeping, grandiose Stravinsky. It's saying, no, there's different ways of thinking that seem to make sense to me now.
Well, let's get the third song out there, going back to your first band, Knots and Crosses, at least the first band of record from your 1993 album, Curve of the Earth, the song Curve of the Earth that you had picked. I see it was re-released again, 2023. There Was a Time seems to be the collection of most of the output of that band, all the output of that band.
We did two different albums and then we reformed briefly for a couple of new tracks that were added. So that's kind of like a best of album. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Curve of the Earth is one of the few co-writes that I ever have. And that's with the guitarist from Knots and Crosses, Rick Harris. And he came to me with the guitar riff for the chorus and also then said, I don't know, maybe it goes here. And he played one chord that might be a verse. And I was like, well, that's interesting. So in a weird way, I wrote that with him almost like a song assignment. Can I make sense of this half-baked thing that Rick just played me? And because it was somebody else's song to start with, the lyrics came fast. The whole thing came like in 10 minutes. And it was all about me. The reason I wanted to include it in this podcast is that it's the first time I really felt like, okay, here's a song where I know I'm singing about me and my moment in time. And for some reason, it took somebody else coming up with a couple of musical ideas to give me permission to do it. So I've always been really proud of this song. I feel like it's something that telegraphed, this is what I'm going to end up doing in 20 years. And in many ways, I think the later Birdsong at Morning, something like Great Escape, it makes sense. Curve of the Earth could have easily been on one of those Birdsong at Morning albums, with the exception that it would have lacked the powerhouse voice of the woman who was the leader, front person of Knots and Crosses, and who was, for a time, my wife. We broke up and kept the band going. So that's a very, you know, Fleetwood Mac kind of way of working. Don't recommend doing it, but it can be done. And she and I are on really good terms now. She runs a really cool venue in the middle of nowhere, Maine, and a ton of great musicians go up to play this place. And we've reformed Knots and Crosses every now and again. We did one last year, gone up to her place in Maine, and just had a blast playing those songs from the late 80s, early 90s.
All right, well, let's hear it. Curve of the Earth.
Gestures of a
So I'm thinking of this in what you were saying about your vocal style in this era. I hear a lot, you know, the sort of dreaminess that is in the verses sounds very much like what people are going to hear when we play the closing song, Somewhere There's a Train.
Yeah.
Right? It's got that sort of Chris Isaak sort of, I mean, you're not soaring to the sky exactly like that, but yeah, any thought about your vocal style at this time? You're even sort of empty gestures, you know, you do it.
Well, exactly. I think it's more exposed vocally than I had ever been before. I think maybe less mannered in some weird way. I think there's a mannerism that's there that I hear that makes me a little uncomfortable, but it ain't nothing compared to the mannerism I hear in all my other vocal parts from the Noughts and Crosses days. Yeah, and you know, the Chris Isaak template, the Wicked Game thing, some of the early Birdsong, if I'd chosen some of those tracks, you would have said, wow, how much did you listen to Chris Isaak? Because the leap up the octave to the falsetto, yeah, sure, it's powerful and I rip it off because it works for a reason. But that's not really what's happening on Curve. That's Carol Noonan. And interestingly, when we do Somewhere There's a Train, there's somebody helping me out on the chorus vocals is a former student, Julia James, and she's got a big voice. I'm about to do a concert actually this coming weekend at school, kind of a survey of all the stuff I've done. So we're going to do Curve of the Earth, and Julia's going to take over Carol's part. And it's one of those songs that I really love, but I can never play unless I've got somebody that can come scream out the big chorus with me. So I'm taking full advantage.
So you say Rick came to you with this kind of funny chorus, slidey riff that something... Was it clear where the vocals were supposed to go with regard
no,
to that?
No, it wasn't. Exactly. I think he thought the melody was the riff. No. This is what I should sing. And then he wasn't sure what to play. And I thought, the riff is cool, but I don't know what to sing over that. So why don't we land and then there'll be a melody. I can even see the
curve. Oh, so did you make space in his riff that it was supposed to be sort of the riff? Was it the same length of a line the way that he wrote it?
It was the same length of the line the way he wrote it. I think he probably envisioned that I would sing a melody over the riff, and then on the chords that follow, he'd play little blues licks and runs and solo and take up all sorts of space because he's a guitar player and it's his song. But then when I flipped that and said, I think the chorus is here, he did, I mean, he's a savvy enough to say, it's a hooky little melody. I'll give you that. So now we've got maybe two hooks. We've got the riff, and then we've got the chorus. And I'm like, okay, yeah. And then my pop song instincts kick in, and I write the rest of the verses in the B section, knowing that, okay, if we do this thing, Carol and I can hit the big high notes just to kick us into the riff. So there's drama and propulsion coming in so that you don't feel like out of nowhere this big guitar comes in, but rather the voices get big, the guitar now answers.
Okay, so the pre-chorus is all you.
Yeah.
Because that's the most...
And the verses.
...super 80s part of it. Put in my dreams, I leave it behind. I love the way that it makes me smile.
Okay.
Clearly, because that's, you know, that was my 82, 83, that was when I was forming my musical opinions.
Sure.
So I have a lot of... But then, yeah, the verses being sort of a more straight, do you know what sort of the prime influence there, apart from the Chris Isaak thing vocally, but like just in terms of that, none of the guitars are you, right? Or were you playing bass at this point, or what are you
No,
playing?
I'm not playing bass. I'm playing the acoustics, I think, and... although Carol may have played I don't know.
It's just the nice reverby, the thick guitar sound that he's using throughout here.
Yeah, through a Leslie... the old Leslie trick, and we got a mock Leslie and did it. Actually, I think I played. That's my contribution. I'm playing the mock Leslie. Yeah, let's think a little bit about the influence. You know, when you think about that 80s moment, I think I can hear that B section being that sort of Tears for Fears, Peter Gabriel, lush mid-80s popness could be in there. In fact, I think Tears for Fears, if you think about the melody of it and the chord underneath, something like a Head Over Heels kind of a Tears for Fears song, that would be a pretty easy reference point. Yeah, but of course at that point I'm in the 90s, so I should get I should catch up to the current view, right? But I think even Noughts and Crosses was always out of sync with everything going on in its time. We liked In terms of pop, Crowded House, that might be another one. Crowded House might be a little bit present in Curve of the Earth. But Richard Thompson was our big god in Knots and Crosses. We were bowed at the feet of Richard, partly because he demonstrated, we all saw him play for the Daring Adventures tour, and it was like, whoa, these are folk songs, and that's one rocking band. It just, everything went full of power, came to life. The solos went on forever. They were great. And it just said, you know, you can write your sensitive folk song, but you can play it differently. And that's really what inspired a lot of Knots and Crosses stuff. We did a cover of Walking on a Wire on our first album. Richard came and rehearsed for his Rumor and Psy tour. He had a touring band. They spent a week in Portland, Maine, getting ready to tour. And I volunteered to be the gopher. So I got to hang out with Richard and the band, which was really illuminating because the gopher, they need you to go get stuff, and then you bring it, and then they don't need you anymore. So I sat around and watched the way they rehearsed, and there was a new drummer, somebody they had hired from Chicago, not one of his British go-tos like Dave Maddox or somebody. So what Richard would do is he would play the song. So everybody in the band, they're playing the song just like on the record, and then every song would become a 20-minute solo. Not because I think Richard was like trying to show off, who's he showing off for, but rather so that the band could find where is the pocket, where is the feel that this needs to come into. And so I was treated to hours and hours of Richard Thompson solos, and I can attest that there's nobody he needs to prove anything to, but I'm in the back of the room going, this guy never runs out of ideas, mm-hmm. never runs out of ideas. I don't understand how this is possible. And he's a really sweet guy, too. Yeah, so the Richard Thompson template would be Knots and Crosses, but I think Crowded House might have been the contemporary version of how we fit in between those two poles.
Let's talk about the end here.
Close your eyes.
Yeah, so this very Richard Thompson-y, was that also a Rick Harris contribution, or was that?
I mean, Rick's definitely playing it, but I think I might have written that. I definitely wrote the chords. I think I suggested the line. I think he probably, and in fact, when you said that, I had a that made me uncomfortable. I think he probably said, come on, do I have to really do the Richard Thompson thing on every song? It's like, no, not on every song, but yes, on this one. So I think he probably, with a smile on his face, acquiesced to play a little Richard Thompson riff, because even though we beat that horse to death, we still loved him and you know, we'll go to our graves as a Richard Thompson acolyte.
Well, any thought? I mean, it's nearly a minute of just fading, playing that riff and singing Close Your Eyes after it, or then, okay, now it's just instrumental. There's a little bit of different guitar voicings as it's fading out, but nothing, not, you know, a reprise of solo, not a Richard Thompson extended noodling, anything like that. Yeah, do you remember
exactly
the deliberations about how to wrap this song up?
I think that was probably me just going, this is kind of like a psychedelic prog pop song, and it's going to fade out like all good psychedelic prog pop songs do. Pink Floyd songs fade out, and you know, there's just, we're going to fade out. We're going to do a fade. It's always a question, as you know, like as a songwriter, the fade is a weird construct. Most people don't write songs intending to fade, but the fade sometimes becomes the solution to an unsolvable problem.
Sure.
How do we end the damn thing? If you think about something like Hey Jude, you're thinking, okay, but that song is about the fade. But it's really two songs, because the lyric section is its own entire song. It has nothing to do with na, 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 na. That's not in the song, doesn't matter. That's McCartney having a different idea. And that idea is, what can we do audacious? Because we've got kind of a boring piano ballad song here, and it's a really good song, and I think it's going to work. But how can we be Beatles and do something? They need something new from us every time. So let's do the 4-minute fade out. Mm-hmm. I have a feeling that's what the ending is all about, just creating a musical sound in order to do the concept of the extended fade out. I've seen bands try to do the perform the fade. That never works.
I mean, just your instrumentals drop out. So then you have just drums or something while the chorus vocals continue.
Something, but they tried to play quietly or whatever. Just like, It's that same, like, you can stand next to a wall or near a wall and step half the distance between you and the wall and then step half the distance again and again, and you will never get to the wall is the whole idea there.
Sure.
Same with the fade. The fade can do it, but we as humans can't do it. So at some point, your toes touch the wall rather than one other increment of dynamic. Anyway, it's most of the time you end up coming with the alternative ending. So when I do the song live, we just hit the riff one more time. Da, 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 da. Yay. Done. And that's a bit of a cliche, cheesy rock and roll moment. But I think sometimes the audience needs to know, is this thing going to end? How's it going to end? That's how it ended. Now I know what to do. I'll clap and we can move on, you know, go get a beer, whatever we need to do. But I feel like the fades imply that the song goes on forever.
Sure.
And in our minds, in our bedrooms with the headphones on,
it's still going on somewhere off in the universe.
Exactly.
That you're not.
But in a concert setting, we're not there. We're in a different thing.
Sure.
We're all about in the moment right now. So I love all the problems that music creates and then all the interesting solutions we come up with to solve them.
So we haven't talked about the meaning of this song, and I'm looking at the three that we happen to have chosen. All of them involve, oh, life is getting you down. Let's have a sort of out-of-body experience. The first song doesn't actually say close your eyes in it, but there's a lot of stuff that probably involves closing your eyes. The dreaming, being entranced, etc. Yeah, was this just a coincidence, or this is part of just what music means to you, is that you are turning off the humdrum world and trying to create this magical place that you can expand out of your body?
Wow. I'd love to think it's the latter, but I don't know. I don't lead an unhappy life. I've not been subject to terrible trauma. All the stuff that tends to sort of give fodder for songwriters, I don't really have. What I do have is a general sense of discontent that I always feel like I kind of maybe want to be somewhere else. So the escape thing that sort of runs through everything that you're, all the songs that we've talked about, is present in a lot of my songs and a lot of my thinking. The dream thing is the easy solution. They're like, yeah, but if I just close my eyes, I'm in another place. Mm-hmm. Rather than, oh my God, I'm going to have to get a bunch of boxes at the liquor store and put all my books in them and then load up the truck and move. And that logistical nightmare is not an escape I wish to do, right? And truth be told, I'm terrified to actually say, you know what? I'm going to just walk out the door, get in my car and go until I run out of gas. I'm too fearful of that. I remember in high school, I told a high school girlfriend, you know what? I know you guys are going to go visit your family in Minnesota. Tell you what, I'll ride up with you and then I'm going to go keep going north into Canada. And the closer I got to Canada, the more terrified I was of, oh my God, it's a foreign country and I'll be on my own and I don't know how anything works. And I never did it. So I think part of the dreamer escapist is, because if that's not the prime theme, vying neck and neck is the missed opportunities theme. That shows up in a ton of my songs too. Mm. Like, but what if this had happened instead of that? And part of me thinks, what if I had just gone to Canada? What if I had actually had just enough courage to do something like cross the Canadian border? How different would my life might have been? And I think it might have been drastically different. So I think that the theme of escape is present. The theme of dreaming is the easiest escape. And the theme that maybe there are parallel universes and I kind of want to leap from one into the next one. Or at least, can I just for a moment open the window and peer into what that alternative universe might be? Because it turns out maybe it's better I didn't cross into Canada. Maybe I made the right choice all along. I don't feel like I have a lot of songs where I reprimand myself for making the terrible choice. Just acknowledging that choices are made and maybe you regret them, maybe you don't.
Well, it's interesting. So the great escape, there's an escape within the escape, because the close your eyes is not you, the narrator who is driving. You can't close your eyes. It is the, this is a long
right.
drive. The comparison it brought to me was the Silent Running, the first tune from the Mike and the Mechanics.
Mike and the Mechanics,
you
yeah.
know, that it sound, and I was looking like, is there any sort of sci-fi? Like, there's not really an explanation of what you're escaping from. If it's just, as you say, we don't like our lives, let's just go, you know, but it seems more like there are watchers on the hills that are going to get, you know, some sort of hypothetical political or sci-fi scenario in which you have to escape something.
Right. I think in my mind, like in sort of my adolescent angsty thing, was like, no, it's somebody in a mental institution and their love interest is broken in and they're crawling. It's almost like Terminator 2. You're breaking in to get Sarah Connor out of the mental ward before the bad guy comes. And we're going to make this escape, right? So the watchers in the night would maybe there's a security guard that's looking at the screen and seeing somebody walking down the hallway. And by all rights, they should hit the alarm. But you're thinking, come on, just this one time, let us out. That's not how we did the video. That's how I probably began writing the song, though.
All right. Well, to wrap up here, we're going to introduce the second single from the new album, Floating on the Dream Line. Somewhere There's a Train, but I don't want to play the single version. I'm going to play the long version because yes. I like the idea that it is continuing to go on.
That song has two different guitar solos, same player, Matt Swanton. And the little tag that goes on in my mind was going to fade. And up until the final mastering moment, it faded. And then I was doing an Atmos remix where I have to start all over from scratch. And I was checking something and turned my back and it didn't fade. And it just came to the end. And I went, wow, I think I like that better. I think I like a definitive moment. And Matt played the solo in a way that winds up. It's not like he's caught unaware. He kind of was like, yeah, I think it should end right about here. So that's great. It's like the anti-fade. Sometimes the hard stop actually is the better choice.
I think there's been more than one time where I thought I might fade a song, but I liked what we did.
Right.
Through the end, you know, there's some songs, The Police come to mind, where there's like some really awesome solo and it just kind of fades out in the middle of it. And like, well, I kind of like to hear the rest of that. I mean, it's a cool image that it goes away, but especially when you are responsible for the sound being on the record, why would you not want to hear it?
Exactly. And there's a Prince song on Sign of the Times where it just starts getting good and he fades it out. And I'm thinking, no, I'm sure there's a 40-minute version of this and I want to hear every minute of it. Why did you fade out? Oh, no. I kept thinking, because I was a big Prince fan and I would buy the 12 inches with all the extended mixes and alternate B-sides and stuff. And I kept waiting. When is this going to come out with the full thing? And even in the big, massive box set that came out a few years back, it's not there. Somebody in the Prince vault needs to find the full version and let me hear the full guitar solo.
All right. I was trying to think what recent, it was Marshall Crenshaw that I had on recently that he has a song that fades, but then it fades back up with a big jam. And it turns out that's from a different take.
Yeah.
But, you know, so that's why they had to fade it out and fade it in. But it was, you know, the I want to have both ways. I want to have it fade, but then I also want to show how awesome the band was.
And if he had done that record with, you know, contemporary computer-based audio, they probably could have stitched it in a way that nobody would have known they were two different takes. But instead, sort of like the Carnival 9, right? That the first thing has to fade out, because of the side has to change. Then we get the rest of it on side two of the album. But if you buy the CD, it doesn't fade.
Ah.
The little sequencer comes in and then suddenly there's the Welcome Back, My Friends. And I remember thinking, I recognize that this honors the way they originally wrote the piece, but it's so much better when it fades in and he says, Welcome back, my friends. I don't know.
All right. Well, thanks so much for chatting. Good luck with the record.
Of course. Thanks, Mark. I really appreciate it. Thanks for having me on. It's been great to talk.
All right. Somewhere There's a Train. It's here.
It ain't stopping.
Every day, exactly like the day before it. No reward, just ignored, bored to tears. Ticking clock, frozen hands alive. Every minute trying, staring out this dirty window, watching shadows, tracing patterns on the glass. Just waiting around, hoping for some nameless stranger, for some danger, for an answer, for romance. Not a chance. There's a train, it ain't stopping, yeah, it ain't stopping. Somewhere there's a train, it ain't stopping, yeah, it ain't stopping. No one climb on board, we're floating on the dream.
Well, thanks so much to Alan. Well, Alan was pitched to me by Wendy at Hello Wendy PR. So thanks to her. And I said yes, only knowing that he was an academic. I'm always interested in talking to musical academics. And I saw that he had a few albums and a pretty immaculate recording style, very clean, everything. And of course, Alan Williams is an extremely common name. You need to look up his website at alanwilliamsevidence.com and you will find what I did, that he has this history, this work with Birdsong at Morning, this work with Knots and Crosses, a very interesting history, a very interesting style. One thing we did not talk about is he does a lot of cover tunes. He mentioned that Birdsong at Morning started as a vehicle to do cover tunes. And I've linked from the blog post associated with this at nakedlyexaminedmusic.com to his versions of a King Crimson song, a Richard Thompson song, a Supertramp song, the logical song, if you recall that. A really interesting version of a George Harrison Beatles song. Usually these are very slowed down. Sometimes they have strings on them. He also leads ensembles at his university with groups of students covering Pink Floyd, King Crimson, Radiohead, Talking Heads. So his musical taste seemed to line up extraordinarily well with mine, which made this a fun interview. Now, given that I recorded this a full month ago, I have slowed down my recording schedule a little bit. I took a good while before successfully recording that interview with Tom Paxton, first-generation folky, presenting original songs in the New York folk clubs before Bob Dylan was. And I have one set up for an instrumental artist that I will not reveal yet, but that I have admired his work since college. To make sure you're hearing all these episodes promptly as they come out, be sure you're subscribed directly to the Nakedly Examined Music podcast feed. And the best way to do that, the way with no ads, the only way to hear the Nakedly Examined Music feed isolated on Spotify is through patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic. You just support me with the smallest of per episode pledges, and it'll give directions for you to set up your private feed URL. You can continue to listen to this on Apple Podcasts or wherever you want. This is the only tangible proof that I will have that people want me to actually keep doing these interviews. So if you sat through this whole hour and a half interview, you were exactly the person who should be signing up for that. So I want to thank my longtime supporters there, T, Marilyn, Ethan, Christopher, and David, and all those that have supported me in the past. The rest of you, do not assume that other people's contributions will be sufficient to make sure this stays in business. You are the change of this world. All right, enough with the hard sell. Thanks so much for listening. Hope you're being creative. Keep on musicking. Until next time, this is Mark Lintonmeyer signing off.